This week on Making Contact.
The biggest number of poor people in America are white people. But you would not know that if you looked at television news.
Racial agendas and stereotypes in the U.S. media are nothing new. In fact, their roots go back even further than the country itself.
The early press, one of its central roles was keeping information flowing among the settlers about the, quote, rebellious slaves and the skulking Indians.
Now, media consolidation and shrinking news budgets are threatening to make things even worse. On this edition, a discussion on the history of race and the American media from the 2011 National Conference on Media Reform, featuring Juan Gonzalez, Rinku Sen, and Carol Simpson. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
Where do I begin? The epic story of race as regards the media.
In 1974, Carol Simpson became the first woman of color to anchor a major American TV network news program.
40 years in radio and television, starting in the turbulent 60s. During all those years, I have seen progress and I have seen erosion of progress. Today, we are in a period of erosion for minorities, on the air and off the air. I used to think that there would be a steady angle of progression. The graph line would just keep going up, and we'd keep doing better and better and get more positions. The line graph has been a roller coaster. And we are now in a down swoop of the roller coaster. A lot of it can be attributed to the contraction of news. News television networks, at ABC, they laid off half the news division that I worked for. We're seeing newspapers closing and contracting and desperately trying to find a way to keep going. Newspaper readership is in sharp decline, and more effort is being put by the newspapers into their web product. That means the media is not concerned at all these days with diversity or hiring more people of color. They are fighting for survival. And you can understand that. Self-preservation is the watchword of the day, so there are fewer jobs for all, and minorities feel the impact the hardest. But let me go back to how long ago African Americans have been fighting in the media for equality. Former slave Frederick Douglass, he came out with the first African American newspaper, the North Star, in 1845. In Rochester, New York. He used its pages to argue not only for the abolition of slavery, but for racial equality. 1845, former slave, trying to make the case. He would become one of the foremost proponents for the end of slavery. President Lincoln sought his counsel. Were he alive today, Douglass would no doubt have something to say about the media's complicity in denigrating and perpetuating negative stereotypes about minority groups. At one of the national networks for which I worked, we had a tape library, and if anyone was doing a story on, say, housing construction, you could go to the tape library and get B-roll, or cover footage that we call it, and you can get scenes of foundations being laid and houses being framed and carpenters nailing and plumbers laying pipe, and you could use that video to help make your story more interesting. And if you were working on consumer spending, there was a consumer spending reel, and it had money being printed and the exchange of dollars with a cash register, a You would see shoppers in malls. You'd see people carrying packages and grocery bags to their cars. And you'd see products on shelves and clothing racks. And you could use this video to make a better television story with the pictures that you were talking about. Guess what we had to my horrors? It was the black clip reel. A lot of us had not seen it because we had gathered our own video of black people for the stories that we were telling. But a lot of white producers that had to run in and get a story on the air about something to do with black people would go to the black clip reel. You know what was on it? Black men hanging outside liquor stores, black pregnant teenagers, gang members face down on the ground as they're being arrested by white police, welfare lines, ramshackle houses, hungry children in the South, black boys with boomboxes blaring rap music. You get the picture. That was the black clip reel. There were no video of black teachers, black doctors, black scientists, black middle-class neighborhoods, black men and women dressed up and working at well-paying corporate jobs, black people going to church or working as community activists in disadvantaged communities. Producers and library personnel put together those clip reels. When we black correspondents found out about it, we went to top management and explain to them the subtle racism that was. That's what white people thought they needed to tell a story about black people. All negative, everything negative. And that racism was entrenched in the news division. It manifested itself in the clip reel, but it also manifested itself in people not being promoted, not being advanced, not getting the same salaries. When I was at ABC News as a national correspondent, I covered a lot of social issues. And when I was doing a story on poverty, I went out of my way to find white people that were poor. Hungry white people. I would hunt them down in Kentucky, in Texas, Oxnard, California. I went everywhere because constantly, every time you saw poor people, only blacks were represented. And yet the biggest number of poor people in America are white people. The largest number of them receiving food stamps are white people. The largest number of them on welfare are white people. But you would not know that. You would not believe that if you looked at television news. I was also doing a story on crack mothers. I reached high and wide and long and far to find a white crack mother. Sure, I'm going to put black crack mothers in there, but I was going to find me a white crack mother to put in that piece. Because what happens is the women that were on crack that were white were the wives of Wall Street guys who would bring them home cocaine, powder cocaine, and they were giving birth to babies in the suburbs that were crack-addicted little babies. And so it was easy for the media just to run to the closest ghetto neighborhood near the TV station and get the pictures that they wanted. But you had to really hunt and search to find and to make sure that people realized it was not just a black problem. You know, it is important for us to be at the table. And I'm talking about the news table, the newsroom, where the editors and producers and assignment people decide what is going to be the news and who's going to go out and get it. There needs to be someone there who says, wait a minute. Now, is that right? Are we going to do a story this way? Which is something, I was such a thorn in the side of ABC. They just, here she goes again. The future does not look particularly bright for minorities, given the economics of media today. It's sad, okay? It's sad. And I just want to finish with, what have we learned about our struggle? That racism is still alive and well. Thank you.
That was Carol Simpson, the first woman of color news anchor for a major American TV network. Coming up next, Rinku Sen, publisher of Color Lines magazine.
In this climate, all of us are really vulnerable to being laid off and to having our jobs consolidated and to losing whatever access we have to the media. And so we're in a situation where everybody's hurting and where white reporters, white colleagues, experience our talk about diversity as a threat. And they hunker down, they build a fort around themselves, and they try to prevent us from getting their jobs. And whatever good intentions there are in the media, that kind of division just really undermines that. And I think the question really is who's actually responsible for the kinds of situations that we're in and for the kinds of shutout of communities of color that have been true in the mainstream media in particular. And I'm going to suggest that one of the ways in which we can create a situation in which all reporters, or as many reporters as possible, as many media workers as possible, are attached to the goal of creating racial equity and racial justice, attached to the goal of closing the racial gap, both in the media, but also in the world, in our country, in the world, ending segregation, bringing people together, not just in their minds, but in the conditions, the actual conditions of their lives, that one of the big challenges is to actually redefine racism. So in our country today, the way that people define racism is the same way as it was defined 40, 50, 100 years ago. And that is as a phenomena that is always individual, always intentional, and always obvious. So if there is no noose hanging, then people will say there is no racism here. There is no discrimination here. And of course, we know as reporters and as consumers of good reporting, of good journalism, that quite often, particularly today, when we have civil rights laws that have made illegal that kind of blatant and obvious racism, we know that yet the racial gap continues to grow and continues to be as strong as it ever was. So if you have outlawed intentional racism, then how can that be? How can you still have this huge gap? And I think that that is because the rules of institutions and of our structures, the system has not actually changed in many, many ways. And when you have color blindness, a concept that makes a lot of intuitive sense, if racial discrimination causes all these problems, you should be able to get rid of it by encouraging people simply not to see race. If color blindness is laid on top of a history of explicit exclusion, that's when you get a racial gap continuing to grow. And so what we need actually is a systemic consciousness, a consciousness about how the rules of our society and of our media institutions continue to keep the racial gap in place. Those rules, when they are written down, they're called policies. And when they're not written down, they're called practices. They're the things that happen again and again and again. So one of the things that we have tried to do at the Applied Research Center and at Color Lines to close the racial gap and to create common ground among all the people who want to take apart the racial hierarchy, all the well-intentioned people, is to focus on the impact of our reporting, of our systems, of our rules, rather than focus on the intention. This can be a really difficult thing because, in fact, there are lots of intentionally racist people out there. They're spitting on John Lewis during the healthcare reform debate. They are raising questions about Barack Obama's birth certificate. But I believe that most of the harm that is created in our country today still, the things that still keep the racial gap in place, much of that is actually perpetuated by people who have good intentions, who, if you ask them, do you think that black people deserve to be represented in these stereotypic ways, would say, no, I don't think so. Do you think that Native Americans are always skulking and alcoholic and gamblers? They would say, no, I don't believe that about Native Americans. But nevertheless, they again and again and again participate in institutions that keep those gaps in place. By changing the frame on this story from who is a racist to what is causing racial inequity, I believe that if we begin to be good at doing that, then we can drive the conversation about race in the media and in the country beyond a diversity conversation, which is satisfied by simply having faces of color in the room, to an equity conversation in which people of color can actually influence the agenda that gets discussed in that room, in this room, as well as in the newsrooms that we're all attached to, as well as in the halls of government. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you so much.
That was Rinku Sen, President and Executive Director of the Applied Research Center. We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. We now return to a panel discussion on the history of race in the American media from the 2011 National Conference on Media Reform in Boston, Massachusetts. Coming up next, Juan Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now!
There's a fundamental lack of understanding that race has been at the center of the development of the content of the American media system. Why do I say that? We are in Boston. The first two papers in the history of the United States were right here. Public Occurrences, Benjamin Rush, 1690. The Boston Newsletter, 1708, John Campbell. Those were the first two newspapers in colonial America. Public Occurrences was a small sheet, had three pages, only lasted for one issue because the Governing Council of Massachusetts immediately shut it down because it was a little bit too rebellious. But I urge you to search on the internet, download, you can find the copies of Public Occurrences, and read the first paper. You will find in that paper five separate items, all dealing with the threat of the Native Americans. There were threats about Indians lurking around Chelmsford. There were articles about Iroquois savages that were allying with the French against the British colonialists. The main subject of that first newspaper was intelligence to the settler community about the Native Americans. Read John Campbell's Boston Newsletter. You will find that that newsletter and most of the other newspapers that developed in the early colonial periods, another big subject of discussion was slave rebellions, individual violence by slaves against their masters. One study, David Copeland did a study of early colonial newspapers in the 1700s, found that up to 30% of the total news whole of those newspapers was dedicated to keeping up intelligence on the Native Americans. Right? So that the early press, while it had no involvement of African Americans and Native Americans, one of its central roles was protecting, keeping information flowing among the settlers about the, quote, rebellious slaves and the skulking Indians that the settlers were confronting. So from the very beginning, the press played a key role in terms of determining not only its own understanding of how the settler society was going to deal with the non-white populations, but also justifying to themselves the spread of the Republic, you know, from the colonies to the then to the Republic and then across to the empire. See, because that's the other problem about our press. Our press, because we are a settler state, every time the settlers spread westward and created new territories to turn into states, they needed their own local press. The press played a very important role in keeping the country together. It was so big. So I think that once you understand that historic role of race in American news coverage, and then, of course, once you got into the conquest of the Mexican territories, it became an even bigger problem. You know, people talk all the time about the ethnic press and as if it's some like minor part of American journalism. There were 25 Spanish language newspapers in the city of New Orleans before the Civil War. 25 before the Civil War, including the first Spanish language daily, Patria, which started publication in 1846. There were over 100 Spanish language newspapers in the old Mexican territories, Texas, New Mexico, California, and the Louisiana territory before the Civil War. Elias Boudinot started the first Native American newspaper, the Cherokee Phoenix, in 1828. The Cherokee had only developed their written language a few years earlier and then educated the entire nation to read and write the Cherokee language. And within 6 years of the development of the language, they had their own newspaper, which was repressed and forced out of existence by the settlers, the white settlers of Georgia who wanted the Cherokee land. There's a long history of a dissident press in America. And the dissident press of America became the African-American, Latino, Native American, and even the Chinese press, which was still pushing forward the idea of democracy and inclusion for all, because unfortunately, many of the working class presses of the period which developed in the 1830s and then turned into the penny press, the commercial press, began to defend the expansion of the empire. So that among the white population, even those who were, quote, progressive, the working man's press, were defending the expansion of the empire westward, of the territorial expansion westward. So that the American commercial press passed from being a dissident press to being a press that defended the status quo. The only ones that continued to insist on greater democracy was the press of people of color. And that continued into the 20th century. In the early 1930s, the Pittsburgh Courier organized a campaign against Amos and Andy. The most popular show in America at the time was also considered by many African Americans the most offensive show. The Pittsburgh Courier got 700,000 African Americans to send letters to the Federal Radio Commission demanding that Amos and Andy be taken off the air. The FRC didn't even answer. Did not even answer. 700,000 people, there were 7 million African Americans in the nation at the time. That means one out of every 10 African Americans in the country demanded that Amos and Andy be taken off the air. That was a media reform movement, a mass media reform movement. And of course, the most important media reform movement in the history of the United States occurred in the early 1970s. Between 1970 and 1973, there were 350 license challenges of the licenses of stations organized by African American and Latino community leaders who most of you have never heard of. Lonnie King in Atlanta, William Wright in D.C., Emma Bowen in New York. They organized their communities. They picketed these stations. They challenged their licenses. There were sit-ins in television and radio stations. And that is what forced the entire broadcast industry to begin hiring the first African Americans and Latinos, to change the content of their programs, to add some program geared to looking at the positive aspects of the Black and Latino community. There was a mass movement that shook the entire industry and then led to the Nixon and the Reagan reaction, especially the Reagan, when Reagan brought in Fowler as the head of the FCC, that began to bring everything back. The problem that we have in America today is that we are heading toward a de facto apartheid media system where the ownership by people of racial minorities, of radio, televisions, virtually no daily newspapers in America today are owned by people of color. Even the few Spanish language dailies that exist now are no longer owned by Latinos. They're owned by a Canadian company with U.S. hedge fund investment. So that you're facing the fact that it's about 8% in radio ownership, 3% in television ownership, and virtually nothing in newspapers. And yet the minority population of the country is currently about 35% and will soon be 50%. So you're reaching a situation where within another 20, 30 years, racial minorities will be the majority of the U.S. population, but will own virtually none of the major media outlets in the country. So that is a major problem of democracy that has to be addressed. The U.S. government did at a time do that. In the late 1970s, Congress created the tax credit certificate, where basically companies that were seeking to sell some of their radio stations or television stations would get a tax credit from the government if they sold that property to a minority owner. And that was the only period of major growth of minority ownership in television and radio. Now, there was some abuse of the system because some companies tried to have minority front people who to be on paper as the owners of the companies instead of really owning them. But for the most part, they really did open up the first significant change in minority ownership in radio and television. The first thing that the Republican Congress did after the 1994 Republican Revolution that came in 1995 was abolish the tax credit certificate policy. And since then, minority ownership has been in decline throughout the United States. So again, there are federal policies that can be put into place that would change the nature from a centralized system of ownership to a decentralized system, an autonomous system. And it's in within that decentralized system that you have greater opportunities for more democratic differences and voices to be heard. And remember, that is part of the original Federal Communications Act. The public interest has been interpreted by the federal courts to mean localism, diversity, and competition. Diversity of voices. It is part of federal communications policy that we need a system that has a diversity of voices. And diversity of ownership has been proven to be a factor, a major factor, in diversity of voices. So it's only a question of like fulfilling the communications policy of the country and adopting the proper governmental reforms that would make that possible. The problem we have right now is that we have a very strong media reform movement that has what is not well connected with the powerful civil rights movement that still exists in America, and in fact, that the civil rights national organizations have been bought off by the telecom companies and by the cable companies, but the reform movement has not built the ties with the largest growing sector of the population. When you unite the civil rights movement with the media reform movement so that they're not isolated from each other, as happened in the 1970s, then you have a powerful movement. Until then, the movements will operate with the civil rights community lamenting the fact that the media is constantly portraying them badly, but not having the force to be able to affect the change, and the media reform movement saying, hey, well, maybe we'll be able to get the right people elected, and we'll get the right people on the FCC, and they'll listen to us, and we'll show them how smart we are and how much we understand all the new technology, and they'll come over to our side. No, it doesn't happen that way in Washington. The only way it happens that way in Washington is when you have a force organized out there in all the different communities that goes after these media companies and that goes after the telecom companies and the Googles and all of the technology companies and forces them to change. So this is what the problem is right now. We have two very good movements, but they're traveling on separate paths, and they're almost living in separate worlds. And until we bring them together, we're not going to be able, I believe, to affect the kind of media reform that will affect fundamental change in the development of our media system.
That was Juan Gonzalez, writer for the New York Daily News and co-host of Democracy Now! And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Free Press. To hear a full-length version of this discussion and many others from the 2011 National Conference on Media Reform, go to our website, radioproject.org. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.